Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
We're now going to listen to another author interview from the archives. In 2012, I spoke with writer Louise Erdrich about her National Book Award-winning novel, The Roundhouse. Set on an Ojibwe reservation in North Dakota, the book deals with the aftermath of a brutal rape and a son's quest for justice. It's part of a trilogy which includes The Plague of Doves and La Rose.
Louise Erdrich joins us in studio. So glad to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
First, I want to talk about this new book because it is... You really know how to write a page-turner. I mean, you know, there are great literary figures, and you are one of them, who open a whole world for us and give us this mythopoetic universe, as it were, a cosmos, but don't necessarily do the plot stuff that can make you want to just turn the pages.
Well,
you do it.
I like doing that.
Yeah, I know you do.
I really
do.
It's partly for me, but in this case, I was haunted by the political situation, that the underlying situation that this book in its events refers
Let's
to.
Let's mention it again, The Roundhouse.
The Roundhouse. Yeah. The Roundhouse refers to a situation where it's very difficult to prosecute crimes of sexual violence on reservations. So I wanted to get this going as a suspense novel so that people would be pulled into it, want to read it, and get a sense of the history, why this is the case, and what's happening today in this book.
It's for educational purpose, in a sense.
It was for educational purposes alone, to make a suspense novel that people wanted to read.
You're like Kingsolver. You know, I mean, she said to me on a couple of occasions, I just want to make people turn the pages so they'll learn from what I have to tell them, whatever that may be.
But
this is also a story that's told, we've got The Perch of Time, but it's really a 13-year-old boy, Joe, your protagonist, and the sense of getting into the head of an adolescent boy. I mean, you do men pretty well, I must say. I mean,
Thank you.
Even going back to Love Medicine, I used to say, boy, she's really, you know, she knows the way men think and all that. But here, you know, you convince us with this voice. There are times when I think, could he really be that canny and smart? But I have to remind myself, this is told from a perch of time.
Right. Yeah. So I've kind of got it both ways, where he's looking back and he's able to comment on the things that are happening to him at the time. But he also, it sometimes moves into a peer boy world where they are doing things that are absurd and getting themselves into ridiculous sorts of trouble. And I can just do conversations between them, and they're kind of geeky kids.
They're tricky lovers, in fact.
They love the next generation.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the chapters all have titles from the first season of The Next Generation. They've MacGyvered a satellite dish that they can use to pull in the signals that come from as far away as Chicago, and they can see the episodes, and they're excited about each one that comes out. So the chapters each have the title from one of the episodes.
Is this from your own progeny, or you're totally your imagination?
It's totally my imagination, which is weird and warped. So I watch
you
them all.
Think
on
like a kid.
VHS.
Too,
yeah. I don't know. I think I had this kind of freedom as a child, where I grew up in a small North Dakota town where I could, and I went up to my grandparents on the reservation. I was able to have that kind of freedom, roaming the town, roaming the woods, really not having anyone worry about where I was at any particular hour, and being able to explore the world in a very different way that children than children can do now.
And with that, you had, I always liked the story, your father giving you a nickel for every story you came up with.
Yeah, he did.
We have to inflate that, you parents who are listening, who think you can encourage a young Louise Erdrich, child is father to the man. Let's not make that sexist, but that's Wordsworth. I mean, the sense of encouraging you to be a tale teller, to be a storyteller.
Well, that really is what I... That's why the suspense, because I like telling a story. A story has to keep people listening and interested. You know, I like telling something that has an ongoing plot. I diverge from the plot. I make it difficult sometimes to get back to it, but it's always, I wanted this one to be tighter and to keep the thread going.
You're listening to a special holiday edition of Forum from our archives. I'm Michael Krasny. Stay with us.
Talking with Louise Erdrich, and by the way, her new novel, Roundhouse, has been nominated for a National Book Award. Do you plan trilogies? Do you think, you know, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a trilogy, or is it just that, like, because this is connected to Flight of Doves?
Yeah, it is, and I didn't plan it, but when I was waiting for some sort of story to come to me, waiting with this haunting situation in mind, I realized that I had a 13-year-old talking to me, kind of telling me this story, and I wanted to go with it. And I thought, well, he's the perfect age if I set this in the first season of The Next Generation. He'd be the perfect age to be the son of the judge and Geraldine who get married in Plague of Doves. So it turned out I
was
had
how you pronounce his name, the judge? Basil?
Basil. Coutts. Right. Yeah. And so it ended up, yes, it's connected thematically. And as I wrote this, another one came to mind, and I thought, I'm going to write yet another book, and it'll be perfect. It'll be three books, and it'll be connected by this particular theme, somewhat about the same people.
You have staked out territory here. I mean, in terms of, it's what Faulkner called my little postage stamp of reality. Instead
right.
of Yakna-Potawa County.
Mm-hmm. And you can say it.
No, but I mean, you've got the genealogies, you've got the myths and the connectedness in the stories and everything. It's rich. I don't think there's anybody else doing this, really, at the level you're doing it since Faulkner.
I don't know. Maybe that's why I get this. I do have this question sometimes, whether I've been greatly influenced by Faulkner or what it is. I suppose I have, but I also am somehow, because I never left North Dakota till I was 18, I put down all of those formational memories as a child there. And so I keep going back to them. The most convincing people seem to come from where I grew up.
There's an old saw about writing that, you know, you have enough, if you have enough material in your youth, you can mine it for the rest of your life.
Is there really? Well, I've never heard that, but maybe that's the case for me. But my parents still live there, and my family's there. So, and my reservation's there, so I go back all the time. I don't live that. I live 3 hours from the border or so.
You have certainly mined a great deal of material from the reservation, from your own experiences, and also from the Germanic side of your family. I mean,
oh yes, absolutely.
Where does the French come in, though? Because I think your mother was half French,
right? So the French have been turned into semi-native people, the Métis. And that was the interesting that happened during the fur trade. You know, French voyageurs came over sort of looking to get wealthy in the fur trade. And in order to make alliances that would be profitable, married Ojibwe, mainly Ojibwe, Menominee, mostly Algonquin women. And in that way, got turned into native people. Their children became native, and they joined in. Now, this is very different than any other really than any other set of Europeans who came over. You know, certainly the Puritans did not marry into the tribes they met. It was a very different sort of world. And so it's an ongoing culture. It's like a Creole culture that exists out in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, North Dakota, into Montana. And some of the people here have some French words that still to this day exist in their language.
That sounds like Creole.
Yeah, it is.
I guess the Ojibwe people were known as the original people. Where does that name come from?
It comes from Anishinaabe, and that's the Anishinaabe Mohin is the language of the people, and it's being revived at a very with very great intensity right now, because the language was really nearly wiped out with two generations of people going to boarding schools, so that now young people have decided they're going to go into immersion schools. One of my daughters is an immersion school teacher. She's working. She's managing.
Learning Ojibwe.
Yeah,
learning Ojibwe. So is my daughter. I told you she studied at the University of Michigan. Yeah.
And it's a huge movement to go back and really revitalize the language. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, needed. I mean, these indigenous people's languages, tribal languages, are disappearing, mm-hmm. and the whole culture is embedded in them. I'm not going to get on my soapbox here, but I think we feel the same about
it. We feel the same way about it, that there is a whole world view that is very important to understand and to communicate in. And when people speak Ojibwe, for instance, there are very few nouns. They're mostly verbs. And it's a language of doing and of community and of seeing, instead of seeing the animate and the inanimate in the world, and seeing a spirit that really flows through everything.
It's like we were talking to Sandra Cisneros yesterday, who I should mention, these two writers saw each other, and Louise happened to be here as well, and it was like, well, it was really lovely to see the kind of embrace and affection that they have for each other.
Yeah,
but,
it was great to see.
You know, she talks about the material and the spiritual world not being different, you know, with respect to, say, something like magic realism.
Right. Well, I think that's very much, but it also has to do with Catholicism, because as I grew up, I really believed that miracles should be part of everyday life. I really believed all of it, so... in Ojibwe, the Ojibwe world, of course, the spirit does move through everything, and you have a sense that there is a living spirit. Even the word for insect, manaduns, it means a tiny spirit. So everything is alive.
Even bugs are spiritual.
Even say you see a stone, the word for stone is animate. It's not inanimate. It's animate. It's got an animating spirit.
You talk about your relationship to Catholicism now. I mean, I always see in my mind Sister Leopolda, you know, trying to drive those demons out in love medicine.
Right. Well, in this book, there's I have a very different character, a priest, Father Travis, who is a former Marine, and he's very good at shooting gophers, and he's also a very complex individual. The boys spy on him. It's 1988, so he's watching aliens on a VHS player, and they're shocked that he probably owns this VHS tape. You know, and he's drinking a Michelob, and Joe says, "Oh my God, it's almost enough to want to make a boy want to be a Catholic just to watch this priest." So he's a sign of the outside world coming onto the reservation and being somewhat more sophisticated than anyone's ever witnessed a priest being. Plus, he's in great shape. You know, he's a Marine. He can outrun anybody.
in good shape. And I suppose you could say urbanized now.
Right.
Or assimilated in ways that come through just with the hybridization of what you've described as this particular character, which is Michelob.
And so they're watching him thinking that perhaps he's they suspect him of a crime, but it turns out it wouldn't be possible for him to commit this crime. So they have this, they get basically tossed around the room by this priest, and I just had a lot of fun writing him because in a way he's a comical figure because of his enormous strength and the way that they don't quite anticipate being caught, tossed, creatively called obscene names without ever using a bad word.
Well, these are boys that remind one almost of like Huck and Tom, you know, I mean, adventure and sleuthing and everything, except that, of course, it's a grim story and it hits so close to home. But
exactly.
You manage to bring in these comedic elements. And I mean, sometimes you're really quite funny, and even though the story is really quite grim. I found myself, in fact, just not, which is a good sign, particularly when you're writing a suspenseful note, not knowing what's Louise going to do next with me here, you know, as a reader, shifting me around.
Well, it's partly that, you know, the elders in this story have incredible license to tease, to be, to talk about their erotic pasts,
got a pretty hot grandma here, in fact.
Right. She has some great memories that she enjoys sharing. We have a 112-year-old great uncle who has not given up on his love life. Yeah.
And why do that?
Why?
Mean, especially in an era of Viagra, right?
Yeah.
talking with Louise Erdrich.
Oh, well, this was 88, but he's going natural.
Not with a ring, necessarily. We're tying in our 2 hours here. And it's a story of a brutal rape on a Native American reservation. And the son, Joe Kutz's 13-year-old boy, who is the narrator's attempt to find out really what happened and to seek justice. It is, as I said, a very compelling novel. And I was saying to Louise off air, those of you who remember, nobody calls you Karen anymore, do they?
Yes.
Do they?
My parents do sometimes. And I was at my 40th high school reunion in Wahpeton, North Dakota, and I'm still Karen.
Still Karen. Yeah. I was Mike at mine.
Yeah.
But I was talking with Louise, those of you who remember the history, she was married to Michael Doris, and they used to write together on books, and there were some tragic events that occurred, including his suicide. And just, it's a tough question to ask, but whether you've grown more since his death and since, well, you two split up. And
right,
in many
well,
ways,
that happened pretty much simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so, I can't really say. I think that my growth as a writer has been to decide in the past two books that I wanted to tell a story straight through with one narrator, basically. And that's been a very interesting development for me because I used to work with these multiple narrators and break up the book and break up the narrative. And now I'm getting these voices that just want to continue, so I just go with them.
This is a book, the new one, The Roundhouse, really, where you're struggling not only with justice and how it's rendered, but it's really a book about revenge and about retaliation.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it's it's a book about where you are forced to go when in the absence of justice, and that's why Joe, the narrator, who is just 13, remembers this summer of his life so searing, with such searing clarity. He remembers that he takes on the burden of justice for a system that's broken and for parents who are fragile. And he has to realize this, all of this in one summer, that his parents are not capable, strong individuals anymore, and he's the one who decides to make decisions regarding justice.
What happens to his mother after the rape, mm-hmm. this place that gives the book its title, Sacred Place, in fact.
The Roundhouse is a sacred place,
yes,
that's right.
But it's, I mean, your rendering of what happens to her, she really falls into pretty bad depression. Everything
yes.
is close to the mark, it seemed to me. I mean, did you read any case studies, or did you just essentially know this from what you had learned and picked up?
No, I knew this from knowing,
yeah.
women.
From life.
From life, yeah. just from life. And I knew it was not something that people sort of think, well, I mean, women get this tremendous violation to deal with on their own sometimes. I mean, it's thought to be something that a woman has to just get over somehow. And I've even heard during my book tours, women have said, you know, I was just told, now you learned your lesson. I mean, there's been this incredibly shocking, I think, discussion of is there a legitimate rape? You know, this kind of discussion has come out during the election.
Missouri Senate candidate, yeah.
Exactly. So she is trying to get over this, but it is a family tragic. It is a tragic family situation. She can't get over it. She's healing any way she can. And she really can't leave her room. I mean, she really has what would be termed now post-traumatic stress, just that she isn't.
And agoraphobia.
Agoraphobia. She has things that would have a name, I suppose, now, and maybe had a name then. But for her, that's just how she's trying to get over this, by not moving, by not going anywhere, by not eating, by, you know, just remaining still in one place.
Now, this all, as you said, takes place in 1988, whereas the Plague of Doves, its predecessor, takes place in 1911.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as I said, the two are linked.
They're linked. So, and I think and the link here is a legacy, a historical legacy in which justice is difficult or impossible to obtain, and what that does to a community.
So we're talking about a family, a community, mm-hmm. a tribe, people.
Right. And what that does to a young person who decides that the burden of solving this is upon him. Sometimes when you leave a book, you wish that it wasn't over. I mean, I had such an extraordinary experience in writing this book of being pulled along.
You were inhabiting him, weren't you?
Yes. Or he was inhabiting me.
Yeah.
I had... So this last character, I haven't been able to let go of him yet. And he's right now, he's my favorite. I wish I was still writing the book, I guess.
Is the third trilogy is it gestating? Is it coming into picture into focus?
Well, it's hard to say. When you're on a book tour, your brain is just focused on the next, you know, whether you can go on to the next venue and still have some lucid thought. I haven't really thought about the book.
It's Thursday. It must be San Francisco.
I know.
But it's yeah. it must be embryonic. I mean, in some...
It must be there.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping it's there because I've loved working on both of these books now. They've been just almost a magical occurrence for me to be able to come upstairs and find my characters over and over still waiting for me. So I'm hoping that's going to happen again.
You've been listening to a special holiday edition of Forum from our archives. My guest was Louise Erdrich on her National Book Award-winning novel, The Roundhouse. Earlier, we heard my conversation with the late Maya Angelou about her book, A Song Flung Up to Heaven. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, Ariana Prale, Blanca Torres, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineers are Danny Bringer and Katie McMurrin. Executive editor is Ethan Tovin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Up Ahead.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.